This is the Living Prophets Podcast, and I'm your host, Mark Maxmeister. This week, I'm going to talk about empire. So much of what still happens in the world is based on the skeleton or the system that was put down long ago that defined the powerful and the powerless. And if we want to end poverty or create change and be successful activists, we have to start using the right words to describe the types of relationships that will put us into community with each other. And empowerment is one of those suspect words. Prosper tells his story of running an organization in Burundi whose purpose was to bring reconciliation and healing after the mass genocide in the 1990s between Rwanda and Burundi, Hutus and Tutsis.
Okay, my name is Prosper. I come from Burundi, Africa. Burundi has been going through hard situation of political problems. The colonialists divided our country. The three ethnic groups that used to live together, we divided them. To the point that when the colonialists left, as he favorited one ethnic group, went on power. And because of being afraid to lose the power, they started killing people from one ethnic group. In one way, I can say that Africa did not have lasting peace because of three different things. So if we cannot talk about colonialism, which is a basic thing of what has been happening in Burundi, I don't think that we can really help to find the solution.
Let me stop here and illustrate what Prosper is talking about when it comes to colonialism. Colonialism and imperialism are words to describe the empires of the mostly European nations in the 19th century who sought to create colonies around the world and subjugate people in order to provide their kingdoms with mass wealth and extract as many resources as possible. In the 21st century, these attitudes largely remain. Those with power tend to think they know how those with less power ought to behave. Here, Mia Zia explains imperialism and colonialism as it influenced the United States' design for the United Nations.
Empire is a relationship in which one state controls the effective political sovereignty of another society. Imperialism, he then goes on, is simply the process or policy of establishing or maintaining an empire. I mean, let's take the simple example of the United Nations. The United States created the United Nations. It wrote the charter practically by itself. It insisted on putting in the right of veto into the Security Council. The other countries, even the Soviet Union, were willing to give up the veto. And the US said, if there is no veto, there will be no United Nations. Go home. And so they caved. They said, okay, have the veto. And the US and the Soviets vetoed the hell out of each other all the way through the Cold War. And so no wonder people thought the UN was completely useless, except lots of us started to believe in the possibility of an international community, international institutions, international law, and process. So did lots of countries. And now the US is stuck.
Here, Noah Trevor of The Daily Show explains his reaction to the French ambassador's criticism of his joke and the colonialism within it.
Yeah, but this was interesting. I got a letter from the ambassador of France, and I'll read it to you. It was about that joke. I watched with great attention your July 17th show when you spoke of the victory of the French team. I heard your words about an African victory. Nothing could be less true. As many of the players have already stated themselves, their parents may have come from another country, but the great majority of them, all but 2 out of 23, were born in France. They were educated in France. They learned to play soccer in France. They are French citizens. They are proud of their country, France. The rich and various backgrounds of these players is a reflection of France's diversity. France is indeed... Now, that line there was interesting. The rich and various backgrounds of these players is a reflection of France's diversity. Now, I'm not trying to be an asshole, but I think it's more a reflection of France's colonialism. like all of those players, if you trace their lineage, you're like, how did you guys become French? Like, how did your family start speaking French? Oh, okay. All right. I'm going to stay here. He says, France is indeed a cosmopolitan country, but every citizen is part of the French identity, and together they belong to the nation of France. Unlike in the United States of America, France does not refer to its citizens based on their race, religion, or origin. To us, there is no hyphenated identity. By calling them an African team, it seems you are denying their Frenchness. Because what do they mean when they say that? Our culture, our this, like, so you cannot be French and African at the same time, which I vehemently disagree with. I go, you've seen those players, I love them. Paul Pogba, N'Golo Kante, I've watched all of them. Like, I love those players, and I love how African they are and how French they are. I don't take their Frenchness away, but I also don't think you need to take their Africanness away. And here's why it vexes me, to be honest. When I read stories from Africa and when I watch what politicians say, especially in France, about African migrants, when they are unemployed or when they are considered unsavory, it's the African immigrants. When their children go on to provide a World Cup victory for France, we should only refer to them as France. And we even saw it with that African man who climbed the building to rescue the baby. Do you remember that? We watched him climb that building. He rescued the child. And then they gave him French citizenship. They said, you are now French. So now I'm going, so is he now no longer African? Is that what you're saying? So when he was on the ground, he was African. And then he climbed up, and as soon as he rescued the baby, now he's French. So if he dropped the baby, the African dropped the baby.
Like. And now back to Prosper's story.
When I finished my seminary, I was the national director of Campus Crusade for Christ International to, you know, to work with the students in schools and with teachers and youth movement. Seeing, you know, the way politicians from both ethnic groups, they misuse the young people by telling them you have to fight for people from your ethnic group, then I saw that was wrong. As a result of that, we lost more than 500,000 people. So we had to start something to mobilize young people around or along a positive thing to rebuild the country and to save the lives of those innocent people. We were the first group to start promoting peace and reconciliation. Okay, there was a man, we had a discussion. I took him to visit many places where we build houses. And that's what we were doing. He was very interested. He told me, we are going to help you to build 700 homes. And then when he went back, I told him, we have to make an agreement, to sign an agreement of how we are going to work together, which we signed. And when he went back in the United States, especially in Ohio, he emailed me, please take materials from construction, and he started to build 700 homes. We will send you money. So I used my credibility, and we started, you know, building homes. And after, you know, a month, we had started. We had already built 270-something houses. Then I asked him to send money. One time they said, oh, we are going to send 136,000, and the rest will be sent. I have never sent the money. And finally, those who gave me construction materials, as I used my credibility, they started, putting me in prison.
How long were you in prison overall?
Twice I served, like 4 months and 4 months again, and so on. I was in prison, say, seven times. So finally, friends in the United States, our partners, they told me you have to sue them. Then they helped me to sue them. I won the judgment. And he was going to pay me around $500,000, but no $1 has been paid.
How did you feel about the foundation or the people in the foundation when this was going on?
You know, I saw two things. One thing, it was a Christian organization. if they could have come and tell us, we are not able to get the money from it. So let us work together to see how we can pay, you know, the debt you have. Another thing, you know, some organizations, they want to use the national organization to use their credibility and raise money. After they have raised money, they will not send money to those organizations.
You don't think that that's a form of exploitation? When you hear the word empowerment, what does that mean to you in the context of your work?
Which kind of empowerment are you talking about?
So what kind of empowerment do we mean? I'm going to let my friend Jennifer Lentfer explain more about empowerment here.
Yeah, I think in the past I would have said, I really want to empower you to do this great thing for yourself. But sort of behind that word is the notion of giving power, right? It doesn't really necessitate that you give up your power. You've basically created an unequal playing field by saying we want to empower women, or we want to empower marginalized people, or we want to empower girls. It's become, you know, really this go-to word. And I said, I think we have to just be more specific, right? We have to just say, we stand with women as they find their own livelihood and voice in the political system. Like, that's really what we mean by empower. So let's just say the truth about what our activities actually are. That's where we ended up.
And what does it mean to stand with?
Ooh, good question. I think for different organizations, it means different things. For my organization, Thousand Currents, it means that we fund. Like, we literally are distributing money to people who are fighting for food sovereignty and climate justice. But ultimately, the way we give up power is to give up and move the money.
So how did we get here? What are the remnants of these empires that remain today and stand in the way of the change that we aim to seek as activists? Why are so many government institutions and charitable foundations whose mission and design was to alleviate suffering for people, in many cases, just creating a new kind of fiefdom of the organizations in the local groups that they work with? Historians might point to a bunch of events that happened after the Second World War, but I think that the Reverend David Miller makes a deeper point of when empires changed from one kind to another kind by subjugating the messages and teachings of Christianity. So I'm going to let him explain this pivot in the Roman Empire and all the empires that followed.
From the prophet Isaiah, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." This text was understood by the early Christians, saying if Jesus was who we declare him to be, the Messiah, the anointed one, the one who fulfills, then Isaiah's vision is now. It is not reserved for a future, but it is a definition of our vocation in the world. These words, found across the distribution of the Roman Empire, across the theological spectrums, and it was clear that in these centuries that these were defining words for the early church. Following the Council of Nicaea in 325, this text, which is found so pervasively in the writings of the church, disappears. There is absolute silence around this text. But as I said of Isaiah's vision, that he believed that the word would not go away, but it would accomplish the purpose for which it was given. So the vision of Isaiah too has not gone away. Witnesses remain. We have seen it in Mahatma Gandhi, in Martin Luther King, in Dorothy Day and Oscar Romero, in Desmond Tutu and many others whose names will be unknown to us. Do we have the courage to see what Isaiah saw? Mahatma Gandhi once said this: "The message of Jesus, as I understand it, is contained in the Sermon on the Mount, unadulterated and taken as a whole. If then I had to face only the Sermon on the Mount and my own interpretation of it, I should not hesitate to say, oh yes, I am a Christian. But negatively, I can tell you that my humble opinion, what passes as Christianity is a negation of the Sermon on the Mount. I am speaking of Christian belief, of Christianity as it is understood in the West. Of all the things I have read, what remained with me forever was that Jesus came almost to give a new law, not of an eye for an eye, but to receive two blows when only one was given, and to go 2 miles when asked to go one. I came to see that the Sermon on the Mount was the whole of Christianity for him who wanted to live a Christian life. It is that sermon that has endeared Jesus to me."
I can think of another way that a foundation could work to find the right people and give them dignity as well as money, and work side by side, hand in hand. I did an experiment almost 10 years ago now called the Global Giving Storytelling Project. And I moved to East Africa and spent a few years there, and working with thousands of volunteers in communities across the region, we got people to go out and interview their neighbors and others that they knew about one time when a person or an organization tried to help somebody and change something in their community for the better. Over time, we managed to amass about 70,000 of these stories in over 50 different locations. And what was interesting is that even though people had a choice to talk about a foundation or a person, roughly half of the stories were about individuals that were making a difference. Individuals that had changed somebody's life or changed a whole community's life. And I wondered, what would it look like if we took all those people who were named in these stories and asked them to go and name one other person that they thought was most worthy of receiving $100 to go and do something good in the community, and then give $100 to each of those people, and then just follow it and see what happens? What type of good happens from this? What are the type of people that show up and get those awards? And how could we then propagate this as a chain of goodwill for others to do goodwill? It's not really a lottery, it's more of a meritocracy, and it sidesteps all of the things that we normally think of when we try to decide who is worthy of receiving money and wealth and power and resources to go and change things. But I imagine that that's closer to the early Christian ideals, where no one could swear allegiance to a king or an empire. No one could take a military oath. Those in the military were pacifists and were sworn not to kill. Soldiers could not execute prisoners. There was a peace from top to bottom in the Christian sect, which is why it wasn't just not the state religion during this time. It was outright outlawed. It was, its existence constituted a threat to the powers that be. And the only recourse was to try to stamp it out of existence, which failed. So instead, as Reverend David Miller explains, they found a way to change the message into something more palatable for an empire. And ever since, we've been living with the consequences. But imagine if we could go back to its roots, the radical part of Christianity. Radical is actually Greek for root. And try more experiments around power that are empowering, not creating fiefdoms and power hierarchies, but instead elevating those among us who are doing the most good. I'd like you to think about that. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again soon.